If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode. Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. Just how rich were Georgian bankers? What did they eat for lunch? And could they really be described as virtuous? Well, in today's episode, we'll be exploring these questions and more in the company of Professor Anne Murphy of the University of Portsmouth. Anne's new book, Virtuous Bankers, draws on the extensive reports of an 18th century investigation into the workings of the Bank of England to reveal how one of the great engines of the British state operated in this age of revolutions. Anne spoke to Rob Attar.
So Anne, your book centres around an inspection of the Bank of England that began in 1783. But before we get to that point, I wonder if you could briefly explain what the institution's history was up to that point.
So the Bank of England was established in 1694, and I guess in some people's eyes it was an accident of war. We have to go back to 1688 and the Glorious Revolution, the arrival of William III as king, and one of his first acts was to take Britain, his new kingdom, to war against France. Wars were incredibly expensive, and it was well known that actually there were a few technological advantages. So it was the country with the deepest purse, not the longest sword, that would win out at the end of the day. So financially, it was about raising enough money to keep going, to stay at war until you could bankrupt the other country. Now, William, being from the Netherlands, brought some sense of how to do that along with him. And there were definitely improvements in the country's finances. But by about 1692, the country had pretty much run out of money and run out of people to borrow from. So they had to come up with new and innovative ways of borrowing. And there were a number of these. So lottery funds, for example, annuities. But one of the most important ways of getting in new money for the state and its wars was the establishment of the Bank of England. So the Bank of England was set up. It raised £1.2 million worth of capital. And that capital was lent to the state to prosecute the war. The idea was that it would just be a short-term thing, and 12 years after it was established, the money would be paid back. The Bank of England would either be shut down or it would go on to just be a private company with no further interaction with the state. But what actually happened was that there were a series of wars throughout the long 18th century. Every time there was another war, the country needed to borrow more money. The Bank of England became more and more established within that process, both as an entity that lent the state money, but also as an entity that then could manage that money for the state and manage the relationship between the state and its creditors. So the more money the country borrowed, the more the bank became embedded in this process of public finance.
And now coming on to the inspection itself, what's the significance of 1783? Why did it happen then?
That's an interesting question, and there's no smoking gun that points precisely to the reasons. But there appear to be a couple of things. The first is that it's the end of the War of American Independence, and this obviously was a loss for Britain, a loss of the American colonies, and the loss of a significant conflict for the first time in that period, with a real sort of loss of confidence, I think, as well. And there had been quite successful conflicts in the mid part of the 18th century, and a sense of Britain being a confident military nation with a growing empire. So the loss of the colonies in America undermined that from a number of ways. It was also an incredibly expensive war, lots more being borrowed, with a real sense that that the money was not being handled well, that the money that was being borrowed was going into the pockets of contractors, people who were supplying the army, and they weren't using it well, but they were also keeping the country in an unproductive and problematic war to line their own pockets. So public finance was a great concern, and the corruption of public finance was a great concern. This all ties in with also an unease about the nature of government and the way that government and government finances in particular, more generally, is being handled. In order to address this, the Prime Minister at the time, Lord North, set up a commission for examining public accounts. This was set up in 1780. This is a government-set commission, and their job is to look at the Exchequer and the Treasury and to figure out several things. So to figure out whether they are doing their job well, the extent of corruption and how to manage that corruption, and where the public funds were, you know, whose pocket were they in, how are they best managed. So there is this context of the examination of public funds. The Bank of England is not part of that, but it might well have been because it's so embedded in the public finances at the time. So that's one element. The other element is that the East India Company is coming under greater and greater scrutiny around this time because of its mismanagement of its own finances, but also because of its mismanagement of the situation in India. The East India Company had become a de facto ruler in India and was known to be mismanaging the opportunities there, creating financial uncertainty. And so the government was starting to encroach on the East India Company's business and starting to take more and more scrutiny, but also management of the East India Company's business. Right at the time that the Bank of England sets up its committee, the inspection that happens, at the same time, there's another inroad into taking management of the East India Company away from its directors and situating it with government. Now, I can't prove it, but I think what was happening was that the Bank of England's directors were looking at this environment, looking at the bigger picture of scrutiny of public finances, the immediate threat to the East India Company, and thinking, we don't want this to happen to us. We will put our own house in order. And in order to do that, they appointed three of the directors. There were 24 directors. So three of them were set up as a committee of inspection to look at what the Bank of England does. And I suppose one of the things that really indicates that connection is that the bank's committee follows exactly the same kind of processes as the government commission that had been set up 3 years earlier.
From what you were saying, is it the case that the East India Company and the Bank of England had a similar kind of relationship with the state at this time?
The Bank of England, I think, was always, or sort of post-1720, so after the South Sea bubble and the collapse of the South Sea Company, I think the Bank of England was always on firmer footing. The Bank of England was always much more embedded in state finances. But both companies were large private organisations run by shareholders, answerable to shareholders, but more and more embedded in the business of government. And whereas the East India Company comes under the control of government, the Bank of England manages to just avoid that fate, to kind of keep its independence as a private company while being a servant of the state and managing the public finances. And I think it does that in sort of quite a clever way, in a way that arguably the East India Company would have found it more difficult to avoid because of the nature of the East India Company's business. But I think also the East India Company's directors aren't quite as smart in the way that they manage their business and they manage their relationship with government.
These three inspectors are appointed by the bank. What are they specifically tasked to do?
So they are asked to look at every element of the bank's business and consider those elements of the bank's business from the perspective of efficiency, security and effectiveness. And they are given the power to talk to any and all of the servants of the bank. So that includes the clerks, the porters, the watchmen, all of the people who are connected with the bank, and to call before them any papers or ledgers that they might wish to see. And that's what they do. They take a year to do this work. And from what we can see, the mode of the inspection was that they would go into an office, they would observe the work that was going on as sort of witnesses. They would have been known to the clerks. I think the clerks would have been familiar quite early on with this process. So they would have felt the eye of the inspectors, I think, behind them looking at what they did. Once they'd had a period of observation, they would then sort of retire to a more private space and they would call some of the men in to come and testify to them. They usually started with the senior men and they would ask them what goes on in this office, what do you see as the rhythms of the day, would very often encompass references to time. So, you know, we start at 9 o'clock in the morning, we finish at 3:30. They'd look in quite precise detail at the processes, but they also asked a lot of questions about how might we do these things better, and were quite good at sort of sifting the replies. So they reference a couple of the clerks as being kind of more old and set in their ways and not really interested in change. But they reference other clerks as, you know, these are people who have really good ideas and we should follow these and, you know, and take notice of what people think would be better in terms of efficiency and security.
What kind of place was the Bank of England at the time the inspection occurred? What would a visitor have seen when they stepped through the doors?
It's already a large space. I can't prove it, but I suspect that this is the largest white-collar organisation in the world at this time. It houses 300 clerks, space for hundreds of customers, possibly thousands of customers coming through a day, 24 directors. There is residential spaces in this place as well. So the chief cashier lives within the bank, the chief door porter lives within the bank as well. So it's a residential home as well as a place of business. It's an impressive building and has been built and designed to be impressive. Already at this point, it's on the Threadneedle Street site. So if you imagine the bank as it is now, it probably occupied about half of the space that it occupies now by 1783. And the bank had been an aggressive landlord, pushing out the residential population from this space, clearing a lot of the streets around it because it was terrified of fire. Knowing that facilities for fighting fires in London at this time were quite poor, it really wanted to make arrangements to protect its buildings from fire. So it wanted wide streets around it. The offices are quite impressive. We can see images of those offices in caricatures produced by Rowlandson and Gilray at the end of the century. And they give us a real sense of impressive buildings designed to impress as well. The other thing that's really interesting about the bank is that because the Bank of England is doing a lot of work for the state in recording ownership of public debt, the trading of public debt is now going on in the Bank of England as well. So it houses the means to record your ownership of debt, but it also houses space for the brokers and the stock jobbers to be there, and an open outcry market that allows them to trade debt within the bank. So it's an incredibly busy, vibrant, smelly, probably loud, interesting place to be. And it attracts tourists as well. It's not only the people who are going there to transact their business, but if you're a visitor to London, it's one of the places that's on your list of must-see. So to go and look at the space, but also to go and look at the market and the transactions that are going on.
Now, I'm curious about one thing you said in your last answer. You said it would have been a very smelly place to be. Why do you think that would have been?
Well, because it's a big public space. It's full of people. It needs to be heated. So there are stoves within it, and sort of the extraction of fumes are not going to be great. So you've got sort of coal fires going on. You've got lots of people who are in a space together who probably would have been perfectly clean by 18th century standards. But there's really interesting work that is being done by a historian called Will Tullett and others looking at smells in the past. And what that indicates to us is that public spaces, because they're full of people, they're full of the smells of people as well. Going outside and around the bank, there's lots of effort to keep that space clear, but we're talking about it being surrounded by roads that are full of horses and therefore full of manure. We don't know what the toilet facilities were like in the bank. They are likely to have had water closets, but there also would have been a cesspit out in the bank yard and probably toilets out in the bank yard as well, which would have added to the interesting smells.
The structure of your book is that you've used the inspection reports and other sources to take the reader through a typical day at the bank at this time. I wonder whether you'd be able to give us a very brief précis of that day. Obviously, you won't be able to go into the same kind of details, but approximately what would happen in a typical day at the bank?
Sure. So it opened at dawn, which they defined as 6 o'clock in the summer, 7 o'clock in the winter. The gates would stand open. There would be a whole bunch of clerks who were there right at that time to get ready for the day. Getting ready for the day was quite a complex business. So it's about taking money and ledgers out of safes, bringing them into offices, getting the offices set up, lighting fires, lighting candles, cleaning and organising is a big part of the day as well. The morning, I think, is the most important part of the day for the bank. There's a midday cutoff point for a lot of the transactions. So a lot of business happens early. And a lot of the business owners, merchants and other people who have business with the bank would have been up and about and around early in the morning as well. And visiting the bank would have been part of their morning routine. Those people who are old enough to remember the city pre sort of 1990s, later 1990s, we'll remember that it used to be full of messengers. So people who worked for banks going from bank to bank with their bags full of checks and other kind of paper documents. That doesn't happen anymore because we are all electronic now. But in the Bank of England of the 1780s, there were 12 messengers who headed out first thing in the morning to deal with customers in their homes with bills of exchange and those sorts of things. A lot of the early business was concentrated on producing notes, exchanging notes, so banknotes, taking in bills of exchange, lending money against bills of exchange, getting the business done for the day. About 11 o'clock, the stock jobbers and brokers arrive at the bank. And the broker's exchange becomes full of people. At that point, people who wish to buy and sell government debt or bank stock would start to populate the bank. In an environment that's probably much noisier and much more disruptive than the banking hall, which was probably a more sort of polite space. After about 1 o'clock, things start to really slow down quite a lot. Again, people who worked in the city a while ago and possibly still do will remember the kind of staggered lunches. So when I worked in the city, I always used to like to have the 11:30 lunch break because I was hungry by 11:30 because you start early. And the Bank of England clerks had precisely that. So they would have a staggered lunch break with some of them going on an early lunch, some of them going on a later lunch. Their lunch probably would have been in a chop house or, other environment out in the city. They might have taken a walk around. They had an hour and a half, so they had a bit of time to themselves. Once they came back, a lot of the senior men would then go home. So the senior men were exiting the bank by about 3:30. And some of them had second jobs, but they would also go and they would take their leisure. They would socialise, they would go home. So by about 3:30, the bank is really winding up for the day, but in the hands of quite junior men. What they're doing at this point is starting to update the accounts and update the records. Everything is done in ledgers with ink and quill. And there's an awful lot that needs to be updated for the next day. So the business of managing the accounts is very intense, takes up certainly the early evening, but sometimes into the late evening. And there are clerks who say, well, I frequently work to 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night. The locking up routines are also interesting. So everyone has left, apart from the residents of the bank, by about 11 o'clock. But the locking up routines kind of echo the locking up routines of the city. So you've got watchmen who are in the bank all night. After the Gordon riots of 1780, there's a military guard that comes to guard the bank all night as well. But mainly they just sleep. And get drunk, so they might not have been particularly useful. And the watchmen are there to guard against riot, to mainly guard against fire and to make sure things are locked up properly. And it's fire that's the biggest risk, and fire that I think mostly the bank is frightened of. And they have really interesting routines around trying to prevent fire. So checking for lit candles, that sort of thing. But also they have their own fire engines, which they maintain. And they do certain things that would allow them to replicate the records if they were lost. So they send duplicates of records out of the bank each day so that they're stored in another place just in case of fire. The watchmen watch mostly all night, but they're probably asleep most of the night as well. And then you get to 6 o'clock the next morning when they open up and do pretty much the same thing over again. And those routines are pretty much the same every day.
And what do we learn from the inspection reports about the kind of people who worked at the bank? What can we find out about their lives and their work?
There's an awful lot that is in the inspection document, but the inspection document also has a sort of cleanliness, a kind of editedness about it. But one of the inspectors, a guy called Samuel Bosanquet, kept a separate diary with him as he went round. And while he was doing that, he was making little notes about the men and who they were and what they did. And he indicates that some of them are fabulous. You know, he's looking for talent as he's going around and he's identifying talent. They are jotting down men's histories and when they came into the bank, the kind of jobs that they've done, how they've learnt about those jobs. But there are men who are drunk on the job. There are men who are rude. There is one who is described as a chattering fellow who is not fit to be put in front of the public. The other thing that the inspectors really have a problem with is that the clerks who work in the transfer offices, the ones who are dealing with the buying and selling of public debt, are becoming jobbers and brokers themselves. So instead of concentrating on their work, they're very often looking out for likely customers who look a bit lost and then offering to be of service to them as a broker or a jobber and sort of charging them on the side for this. They're also working with some of the external brokers and jobbers to point out those customers and to kind of facilitate that business. And one particularly interesting one is a guy called Abraham Vickery, who was one of the supervisors in one of the transfer offices. And Vickery is working with one of these brokers, often concentrating more on that business than his own, but also deeply unpleasant to the men around him. He's the only supervisor who comes into the inspection and says, right, I'm going to tell you everything that I know about these men and I'm not going to hold back. And I've told the men as well that I'm going to tell you everything that I know. And he, you know, he's very critical, but also the men who are around him are very critical of him. So there's clearly really tense relationships there. There are also not many, but a couple of individuals who use their position in the bank to undertake criminal acts. And that's quite interesting as well. The bank does prosecute them to the full extent of the law, which does mean capital punishment at this time, which is probably the thing that keeps men as honest as possible. But there are some really interesting examples of embezzlement. And it's notable that they're using their skills that they've acquired and the knowledge that they've acquired in the bank to try and get away with that kind of behaviour for as long as possible.
Nowadays, bankers have a reputation, I don't know if it's fairly or unfairly, for being very highly paid. Was that the case at this time too?
No, certainly not for a good proportion of their careers. The bank operates an internal labour market, which means it only recruits at entry level. So it only promotes men from within. It wouldn't sort of go out for a chief cashier to another bank. Everybody starts on £50 a year, and the starting wage had been £50 a year since 1694. And was still £50 a year 100 years later. And there had been inflationary periods during that time. So it's a real strain, actually, for young men to live on £50 a year in the 1780s. There's a pamphlet that suggests that they're just on the verge of respectability if they live on £50 a year. And they're not saving money for a rainy day. They're not saving against sickness. And they definitely don't have enough to get married. It generally takes them between sort of 3 and 5 years before they start getting pay rises. They do get relatively regular increments after that, but they've probably been in the bank between 10 and 15 years before they start being really in the more comfortable areas of the middle class. When they get to the higher echelons of the bank, they are well paid. So we're talking about sort of £250, £300 a year. And the bank retires them on very generous pensions as well. It can afford to do so because a lot of these men work until they're quite old and infirm. So the bank's pension bill tends to be high, but for a very short period of time, because most of these men are sort of dying 2-3 years, maximum of 5 years after their retirement. It's a respectable profession, and if you can hold out for long enough, you'll be very comfortable. But it's not a profession that you enter into if you want to earn vast amounts of money. There are supplements to that, though. So public-facing areas of the bank, those clerks will get tips and gratuities, fees from customers. And also there are the opportunities for taking second jobs, especially for those men who are leaving early in the afternoon, or those men who are working in the transfer offices who can become brokers and jobbers.
So the inspectors, as you said, spent more than a year at the bank. What conclusions did they draw from their inspection, and how far were their recommendations implemented?
So they look at the bank very holistically. There are certain things that immediately concern them. So things like the production of banknotes, they identify quite a few risks with that. So they identify the problems, they make suggestions for changes, and those changes are implemented very quickly. Likewise with the public-facing bits of the public debt process, they recognise very quickly that offices are understaffed and the workflow needs to change in order to serve the public better. And they make those changes quite quickly as well. There are more complicated changes, though. So they recognise the problems with receiving gratuities and tips from the public, but they also recognise the embeddedness of those sorts of practices in 18th century society, and they know they can't do anything about it. So what they try to do is manage the problems, particularly the problems of the senior men sort of trying to take all of the money, encouraging the junior men to be a bit more duplicitous about it. They try to sort of smooth those. They also recognise what is quite a significant problem for them, which is the senior men disappearing at 3:30 and not being there for what they see as the critical part of the day, which is the bit where everybody is locking up and kind of making safe. So they attempt to change that. And they attempt to say to the bank that you must look more to the merits of individuals than promotion on longevity. So it's clear that a lot of men had been promoted because they'd been at the bank a very long time and it was their turn next. And the inspectors are quite good at turning around and saying, actually, there's a fairness to that, which they recognised. But they also wanted the directors and the governor particularly to have more of an eye on the capacities and merits of the men that they were promoting. So it wouldn't just be about longevity. It would be about capability as well. Their final conclusion, though, is a really interesting one. Whereas today, I think bankers are really hesitant about talking openly about how they value themselves and how they value what they offer to the public. The inspectors really openly said that they regarded the bank as central to the commerce of London and to the nation, to the smooth functioning of the public debt. They thought that it should be regarded as what they describe as a grand palladium of public credit. And they believe that the public should hold the bank in religious veneration, which is a kind of fascinating way of thinking about a bank today. I can't imagine that we would ever be able to say to the public, please hold your bankers in that kind of esteem.
And that, I suppose, explains the virtuous banker's title of your book.
It's certainly not a title that is about the individuals. You know, there were some virtuous ones. There were some terrible ones. There were some criminal ones. There were some incompetent ones, as there would be in any population. But the virtuous bankers, I think, is about two things. It's about the way that the men, the clerks, the directors, the inspectors viewed the business of the bank and its relationship with the public. And it's also about the way that the inspection was set up to demonstrate the virtue and incorruptibility of the bank. You know, it's demonstration to the state that here is an institution that can be relied upon.
From what you know, do you think that the public did agree that the Bank of England was a virtuous institution, or would they have differed from the inspectors on that?
From what we can make out, the public did regard the bank as a venerable institution, as a trustworthy environment. There are a number of people who are critical of the bank's monopoly and critical of its relationship with government, but most of those people still tend to agree that it did a good job and that it could do a better job perhaps than the Exchequer could do of managing the nation's finances. From the perspective of the public who used the bank, there were anxieties and there was impatience with slower processes, but there's no indication that they don't find the bank to be trustworthy.
Now, obviously, the Bank of England has changed a huge amount over the 240 years since this inspection took place. But if somehow our inspectors from 1783 were to visit today, what do you think they would see as the biggest alterations, and is there anything they would still recognise?
I think there is plenty that they would still recognise. You know, the bank's architecture still has echoes of that 18th century space, including the committee room, actually, which is an 18th century reconstruction, despite the fact that the bank's been pulled down and reconstructed from there. Those who are interested in seeing what 18th century spaces would have looked like might go into the bank's museum as well, where those kind of spaces and environments are preserved quite nicely. I think they'd be most surprised at the fact that since the nationalisation of the bank in 1946, the embeddedness with government and the responsibility of the bank to help to manage the economy, to help to manage inflation, to help to manage interest rates is so obvious now. It was something that was starting to become embedded in the way that the bank was working at the end of the 18th century, but also something that they resisted as a duty or as an expectation of what they did. Now it is an expectation of what they did. I think they would also recognise processes, checks and balances, the way that accounting works, but of course the technology of accounting and the technology of managing those processes would have changed incredibly over that time. And I suppose the other lovely thing is if they wanted to go and look at all of the ledgers that they could go and look at during the inspection of 1783, they're all still there, well preserved and available for anybody to look at.
That was Professor Anne Murphy of the University of Portsmouth. Virtuous Bankers is out now, published by Princeton University Press. And if you'd like to hear more on the history of Britain's central bank, then check out the episode Anne and Rob recorded for our Everything You Wanted to Know series. Just search for Bank of England History in your podcast feeds to bring that up. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Brittany Colley.